Hi. good. This is A Life in the Theatre, Ruth McCree, and it's July 19th, 1991, right? Still is it 91? I've been here 2 weeks. It doesn't matter. I have a son who works on a boat in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's a little Japanese boat that he was on, and I asked him how it was and if it just felt terribly confining, and he said, no, you know, after a couple of weeks, it's the whole world. So, my name is Ruth McCree, and I'm supposed to be leading this session, but I would very much like to conduct it on the basis of your curiosities. You know, what interests you about this, the idea of a life in the theater? How many of you have worked in theater? So I can find out. Okay, well, community theater too. Well, yeah. Oh, well, you know, you never know. You've come across people all the time who have done that and then graduated or moved on. And are trying to keep from feeling like they've dropped out. It's very hard to get over this thing that drives you into theater.
I used to be a friend of mine. His son is in the theater.
Oh.
By the name of Mitch Geiser. I don't suppose you.
No, is he in Seattle?
No. But he's been back all over, and he's great at drawing.
Uh-huh.
And they, down in Coos Bay, they've got this little theater on the bay, and he's kind of helping down there. But he just kind of floats around. I mean, he don't seem to have any real job or anything.
He's just summed it up. Well, good for him then. In that case, he's doing better than most. Yeah.
He was with, and well, he can sing too, but he was with those, Disney? Yeah, down in Disney.
Yes, it's very interesting. For actors, the least satisfying work in terms of acting is in film and video. I was talking with Glenn yesterday, right, about that, that it's very, very frustrating because when you work in film and video, you're relating to a camera often, you're doing things out of sequence, you're here and you're there and there's all this technology and you do one take and you find out it won't work because an airplane came into the end of the shot and so we have to shoot it again because of the noise or there's a siren outside or else you're working against the light, you know, the light coming in the window, and then there are too many takes, and the light goes away, and then you have to simulate the light, so then you have to set up to simulate the light, and then they're racing to deal with overtime, and so there's all this tension and pressure, and what you do has to be so technically controlled, and the big thing is keeping your energy up, so that you can do at 4:30 in the afternoon what you set out to do at 9 in the morning, and to keep, you know, that sort of thing. So it's really bizarre, and that's the money, that's the place where the money is in that kind of work, because it's much more saleable than live theater. Live theater's often not cheap, but it's, especially in New York and at the Fifth Avenue in Seattle. I should fill you in on this. Ruth Ann and I were talking at lunch, and she'd gone to see Les Miserables twice, and tickets were something like $45 a throw. And so a lot of us in theater who desperately have followed this from London to New York and thought, oh, it's coming to Seattle, and I have a friend who works in the box office there. He wasn't going to be able to see it. I mean, they wouldn't even give them a break on the tickets. At the Fifth Avenue.
We have a neighbor's daughter working.
Ushering?
1 year, mostly.
Oh, no. Was she ushering?
No.
Oh, she was performing. Managing. Oh, she was managing. Mm-hmm. She may have gotten to see a show or two.
I mean, she's now living in Seattle Center.
Oh, really? Oh, good. Good. Yeah, well, and if you get enough of that work, you can sometimes support your habit in the other parts of theater, you know.
She's married with two children, and the husband also carpenters and does other things.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Hey, $45 a throw, you mean $45 a ticket?
Yeah.
Heck, I can go to all the community playhouse shows and do some balls for $45.
Well, we go for free. We go on senior citizen night. We go to dress rehearsals.
All right.
Annie and Chicago.
Good. Well, good, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one thing I wanted to say, that if you do love theater and you you know, you find the tickets stiff, although I encourage you to pay full price every time you can, because they need it desperately. but there are ways of getting around it. And some theaters are even doing now a free performance or two, because of the idea that it should be that theater should be more of a public event, not just an elitist event. And that, so like a Local Access in Seattle is doing that. Intiman has, which is one of the big four theaters in Seattle, is now doing a Pay What You Can Day. And so I thought that was for all of the seats, but it's for the seats that aren't sold, as it turns out. But still, you can see theater that way. So it's... That's right. That's right. Well, of course, it depends on who doesn't show or something. So you might accidentally get a good one. So there are rush tickets too. Day of performance tickets that you can get. And
well, we have to understand that where we live, it's a couple hundred miles from Minneapolis, and we can go there. You know.
Wonderful.
And go there periodically for their theater.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
And also the Chan
has. Uh-huh.
If you know Chan.
Oh, yeah. Although I hear they're having a hard time, too. Or closed recently.
Oh,
I don't know. I hear
it. The Alt Center in Eugene is the closest place. We have 130 miles, and we go to Portland, about 200 miles to go there. But we took them very cold. Only if it shows they put an island in the center.
Uh-huh.
But we haven't gone to the other plays. Performers.
Uh-huh.
Theater group that you belong, is that like a
repertoire thing? No, our theater is a little different. I belong to a company I helped form several years ago called Playworks, and we were here last week doing a couple of shows and have recently put out this brochure, which I will give you copies of later. And our idea is, we started doing a play about Emily Dickinson called The Belle of Amherst. It's a play by William Luce, and many of you have seen it probably Harris, Julie Lee Harris in it. And she did it for television and toured the country for years. Now she can't afford to do it because the royalties for her to do a performance are like $2,000. And so she can't do it anymore. But anyway, that's a contracting problem. We formed this because people said, well, do you have something shorter about Emily? Or I'd like to have you come to my group, but we're small and it's probably too long, and so could you do something in an hour, you know, about an hour length? And that's how Vesuvius at Home got started. And it was the first thing in our roster of productions. And then David Klein has the Dr. Keel show, which we've put together for touring again. And we have two shows we're touring for the Washington Commission for the Humanities. And they came out of some of our conversations about the nature of interpretation and literary interpretation, dramatic any kind of interpretation. And so we wanted to give people an idea of how it happens, you know, how one text can mean many different things, depending upon, you know, who's saying it. Who the people perceive themselves to be, who they are in relationship to each other and all. So I take part in the Chekhov show, where we do a scene from Seagull and a scene from Cherry Orchard. And we play each scene three different ways and then have dialogue with the audience. The audience gets to ask questions about, you know, well, you know, you said this and you said this, but they weren't the same, you know. How does that happen? And so that's been great fun. So we have those four, and then Annie has a show called The Tenth Muse, which is based on the, it's about the creative, creativity, women's creativity as poets over four centuries in the New World, women in the New World. So she goes everywhere from Anne Bradstreet to, you know, contemporary poets and Latin American as well as American. And so we have these this roster of shows which are bookable. And we've been on the East Coast and in the Southeast and in the Northwest with them. But this is our first actual brochure for marketing, and we're getting that out when I get back. So we're hoping that it will be, you know, we'll be able to book more solidly. It's a matter of getting a business started. Also, we're doing after school, there's no drama in the middle schools, and we started an after school drama program through Playworks again. And in that, hope to then create drama, an opportunity for kids to grow and learn through drama after school, in the school where they go, for an hour and a half, twice a week, with the same teacher for 8 weeks. So it's 16 sessions in the fall, 16 in the spring, and then it'll be 16 sessions in the summer, but in a four-week period rather than an eight-week period. And that's been funded for next year, which is pretty exciting. So we're hoping to get that in all the schools in another couple of years. Yeah, yeah.
How is that funded?
It's actually hotel motel grant, you know, tax monies. It's a percentage that came once the kingdom was paid off. There's all this brouhaha in the member. That's what all that was about.
It's not close enough to Seattle to stay.
Oh.
I don't get the Seattle paper.
Oh, well, that spare yourself. Take the New York Times. So that's the sort of thing that we do. Yes, I work in professional theaters in Seattle, but the work is very sporadic. And I moved to Seattle because I wanted to be able to live and work in the same place. I know if you can travel around a lot of places, then you can audition for a broader number. But you don't have a home and do that. And since we have a child, you know, she was five when we moved here, I didn't want to be gone all the time. And so I don't even audition for things outside the city. So I do audition for things in the city, and that is increasingly hard. One, as I get older, because there are fewer and fewer roles just in the literature for fewer roles for women, far fewer. I mean, there are about five roles for men for every one role for women in dramatic literature. And then there are a lot of the women's roles are for younger women. I mean, you know, the ingenue, right? And so that's one of the realities. And so we had to look at that and say, well, this is the way it is. So what are we going to do now? Stop working? And so Annie Ludlam and I decided to form this company about 5 years ago, and it's continued, so we must be doing something right. So we do those two things.
I should show you this, I guess.
This is an example of a typical, typical theater headshot. And I've clipped the resume to it in the back because it's the wrong size paper. But ordinarily I would put a spray glue on the back of the photo and then turn the resume over so it would stick to it. And on that kind of a resume, you put down a sample of the work. On theater resumes, they don't want to read a lot. They want to just want to know the basics and who you've worked with, where you've worked before, and what shows, what type of roles you've been cast in before, and that sort of thing. So that gives them a quick sketch of that. Is that my theater? Is that my update on it? Oh.
1991.
Yeah, that's the update. I shouldn't have done that, but I decided all of a sudden to start auditioning again. I haven't auditioned for about a year and a half until this spring, and then I decided, oh, I'm just going to do it.
Where did you start out?
Actually, in the attic of my dad, of the parsonage I grew up in.
back in New York or something?
No. But when I was very young, we did Sunday afternoon entertainments up in the attic, and It was one of my earliest memories doing that kind of stuff. And then when we moved to Detroit when I was 9, I started going to a recreation center and on Fridays doing to a drama class. I'll never forget because I was highly insulted. My mother had sent me as a ploy to get to break up fights between my sister and me. She's 2.5 years older, and we were just, you know, at one another too much, and so she wanted to get me out of the house, I guess. But also I was in the middle of a tomboy phase where I was just, you know, anything that boys did was stuff I was interested in trying and proving I could do. And so I'll never forget that trip over to the recreation center, grumbling under the umbrella of my brother about how she was trying to domesticate me, you know. Of course, I thought it was a wonderful word to use, and I used it a lot, but it wasn't quite apropos. Anyway, I went there, and so, you know, slumped down in a back seat and saw what they were doing. And what they were doing was taking fairy tales. There'd be a fairy tale, and they were, everybody else was down in front except for my brother and me. And then they all raised hands for, I want to be this part, this part, this part. And the leader gave divvied up parts. And then they all went up on stage and started telling the fairy tale. And they did it just by figuring out, you know, well, what will we need? Where does the scene start? Well, it starts in, you know, so-and-so's house. Well, what do we need? Well, we need a table. The mother's working at the table. Well, what else do we need? We need a fireplace. And so they'd set that up, and then they'd play the first scene, and then they'd take that away, and then they'd set up the castle where the next scene goes, you see. And they began doing it. I think, oh, yes, they were doing Sleeping Beauty. And so I got hooked.
Did you read your part?
No, it was all improvisation. And I wanted to go, and I wanted to be the last fairy. I wanted to be the wicked fairy, you know. Because I felt that, well, the girl who had done it had mumbled, and, you know, she hadn't really put anything into it. And so it would be such fun, you know. So we did it. And I was hooked. And so ever after, I did that until I could get into, until I went to a school where they did plays. And then I studied ballet and several other things related. But then when I went to college, I went to Valpo, where they had a very small, and still have, I understand, a very small drama department. But I was there at a very fortunate time. We had some wonderful profs in that field. Vera Hahn was the head. I don't know if you know Vera. She's been retired for many years. But we got to do everything, and I got an assistantship and worked my way through college, basically working in that field and studying. And then I went to the Goodman at the Art Institute in Chicago and studied there. And then since then, I've studied a variety of places with people in voice and movement and one thing another. I studied at American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco, and ongoing. It's an ongoing thing. And the reason that it has to be an ongoing kind of training is that you have to keep your channels open for the work in order to be flexible so that you are able to engage the roles that come along as fully as possible. And because the resources that you carry in you are the only ones that you've got to offer and to work through. And so that's just part of it. And it sort of keeps us alive and stimulated as far as growing is concerned, challenged. I belong to an actor's studio up in Seattle. And until I got involved with some other projects which took me from it, I was doing a weekly workshop on improvisation where actors would just come and drop in as they could, you know, if they weren't in rehearsal in a show, or even sometimes before rehearsals for a show, we would just simply work out Thursday mornings for about 2.5 hours exploring things. And we would take turns. None of us was the leader, but anyone who was there was to feed into, you know, where the movement went for the day. So we would do something like explore. We'd say, okay, you know, I've got some idea, an idea about status. I want to play with status today. And so people would contribute, you know, well, let's try this. Well, this is something I've tried before, and we did this and that. And so it was kind of a sharing and learning new ways and reminding about old. And that was terrific. So it was out of that workshop, really. That was simultaneous with my daughter's going to middle school, my discovery that there aren't any arts in the middle schools to speak of. A dabble here and a dabble there, but nothing with integrity as far as education, and nothing with any seriousness in terms of amount offered, opportunity to work or to grow. And so that's how the theater games idea came about. And I think we're going to change it to the drama workshop. Some people have said, well, that's Boland's term, so we're not going to. I don't know. It's theater games for this fall. So so then in 82, then I married and had kids and raised a family and didn't do any theater for about 15 years. And then wanted to go back and work in theater. And so we weren't in a place where there was any professional theater at the time. But what I could do was go to grad school. So I went to grad school and got a degree, a master's in theater. And that was a good experience. Had a terrific aesthetics course, which was very helpful in reconciling my dilemma between doing something useful and doing theater. And John Dewey's book is wonderful if you ever need to deal with that subject. He has a book called Art as Experience, and it's dynamite. And it was very helpful to me in reconciling that tension. I thought I should be a social worker, but I discovered it doesn't help people. If the person they're trying to get help from is sitting there sobbing with them, it doesn't help anybody. So so I got a degree in theater. And then my husband got a sabbatical in Seattle, and we were able to go. We decided to take it there so that we could see how employable I was and whether or not I was employable, having been out so long. Well, no, I started to work before we left. I went to Atlanta and took my three-year-old with me to Atlanta to work at the Alliance, and then stayed on after Bob left doing summer stock in South Carolina. And that was before getting to Seattle. And then when we got to Seattle, I did get work. So I just felt I'd come home, and I really couldn't go back to South Carolina. So we've stayed there. It was a few years before Bob could get out, but he's managed that now. So that's what we're doing. Then, so there's the theater company, there's the professional work in theaters sporadically, and then the commercial work. And I'm passing around this one so you can see what the difference is. This is not only a little bit more recent than that photo, but also the resume is different. And I've got to update this baby. Let my agent get after me first. For the commercial work, we have agents. You don't have an agent for theater work in Seattle. In New York, you do. And in LA, you don't either. Just in New York. But the commercial agent does all the negotiating through, you know, SAG and the unions, the SAG, the film union, and the television radio union. And that's a whole another ball of wax. It's bizarre. And with the economy down this last year, it's been really felt. Even the young men are feeling it. Ordinarily, you can really take that as an indicator, but if they're grousing about the work, they're just, people are using old things. So, for instance, the Pay and Save spot that I did, couple years ago now, is still being run, and ordinarily they would have updated it, you know, 9 months later at least. So I keep expecting them to drop it, but I think with the economy they just have figured it's cheaper to keep buying it. So they're And the Metropolitan Federal Savings also was, they bought that for a couple of years, which surprised me a lot. But that's...
Is that mostly television?
It's television, yeah, a lot of, and radio, yeah. And film as well. But there are very few calls for women my age in film. And if they are, then they're usually cast in L.A. or New York. Seattle's a very secondary, tertiary kind of market for filmmaking. And they usually bring in the lead roles from other places. And they pick up their extras there. And my agent doesn't do bookings for extras. We don't do any of that. But speaking roles, smaller speaking roles, she will. So I get calls periodically for doing. I get maybe a call or two a month. If I get two calls for an audition a month from Carol, it's good. So it's not a lot. Very, very bizarre.
How does the endowment for the arts work for the theaters that you're working? Because I noticed when we go to a Saturday afternoon children's one, and the college kids come in, you know, on a bus, and then they do children's theater.
Yeah.
And then we go to the St. Louis Repertoire, and that is professional.
Yes.
Like you are. And then we also belong to, and I'm sitting here trying to remember, but it's a group. And they are funded by the Endowment for the Arts. And that's why I'm sitting here thinking, now, does your state have that?
Yes, they do. And them's as high as gets.
You know, so, well, this one is really interesting. You know what? No, I didn't interrupt.
That's right. Yeah.
Maybe they do it there where you are. They go to all, right now, they're having it on Sunday afternoons in a big building that's being built.
Oh.
And they take advantage, you know, and it's really informal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then we go in, if any of you know St. Louis, we go into the Soulard area, which you wouldn't want to go into at night. Maybe we go into an old beat-up building, and the theater is there that Sunday.
Wow. You mean they float between?
They float.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Good. Mm-hmm. Well, in our area, an organization our size would not get money from the National Endowment for the Arts. They would send money to, Humanities, the Washington Commission for the Humanities, money comes through that endowment, basically. And so in some way we received from that, but not us directly. Seattle Rep does. Intimon Theater does. The big ones do. Yeah. Yeah. The ballet, I think, and the orchestra may. But it's the big ones, yeah. The state organizations are more likely to do some funding for groups such as ours, but really on a level above ours too, or that work in somewhat different ways. They're really concerned to get the arts into areas where there aren't any. And so, yeah, it really is. So, that's sort of an overall sketch of what it's like. I don't know if you have any questions about why people would do this, or I'd certainly do. That's a form of insanity, really, isn't it?
Well, it's. I mean, there's always a chance of hitting it big, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
it's kind of a gamble.
It certainly is a gamble, and I suppose life is a gamble for everybody in one form or another. I know that for me, I've just always loved stories.
Mm-hmm.
Loved stories. I mean, I could never get enough stories. And some of my happiest, earliest memories are being in, you know, for the story hour in front of the radio at 4 o'clock. You know, back when I was really little, and just always sitting there with my ear, and I was in another world. And so that's always interested me a lot. And I love the collaboration. I love the working with other people and the playing off of other people. And you never know from one rehearsal to the next, you know, what variations that are going to make, which will open up things inside of your own experience and put you in touch with a whole new aspect of what you're doing. And so it's a game, it's a lot like playing.
Well, I mean, you'd have to like to do that. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, from what I've read a little bit, there's always the hope that somebody will be out there in the audience that will say, hey, that's the person you want.
Yeah, but believe me, it doesn't keep you going. I don't know. You know, that hope, if that's your hope, you're going to be pretty tough. Because it happens so seldom. And also, you know, sometimes we get found by people who don't, you know, aren't really able to do anything in terms of career. And the thing is that all of that's passing anyway. All of that, that's temporary. You know, there may be one, you do get to do this great thing, but, you know, what does it mean finally? So as much as possible, you try to find ways of working with people whose work you respect and who are serious about the work, but to put up a piece that will have meaning for other people, that says something you want to say, that communicates an idea or an experience that is going to make them richer in some way. And that's the only, for me, the only good reason for doing it. That sense of doing something meaningful for other people is just terribly important. And I pray God it's not all illusion.
Well, you like to be entertained. You like to come away with a good feeling when you go to a play. Mm-hmm. And you go kind of for entertainment. But if you come away with a good feeling, that is so much better.
Yeah. Or even an insight, even in some insight about human nature and human experience, the sense of having company, having kindred experience with someone on stage. In a way, it brings the human body together a little bit so that you don't feel quite so lonely or isolated or irregular, maybe. Well, it's interesting. Most of the people I know in theater feel like fringe people on the society, in the society. And in a way, you have to be in order to stick with it, I think, because otherwise the other things are so important that you find other ways to make money, for one thing, and to sort of keep up with where the society is. But I think for a lot of us, and I'm sure for a lot of you too, there's always been a way in which you're in school and it's second grade and you've got your desk and you've got your books and you're getting all the studies like all of the other kids, but there's a way in which you're doing that you're also taking in all this information about the others around you and the smell of the books and the fact that your new shoes pinch a little bit, but they really are great. I mean, all of these extraneous sensory things which are all kind of registering in there too, and you're observing the group. While you may be on the fringes listening to it, you're also observing it and kind of taking in information about, you know, the fact that, you know, some people are on the inside and some people are hanging on the outside, and so-and-so always looks glum, and so-and-so always makes these snide remarks with a glum look on her face, and, you know, and how that feels, you know, and how so-and-so felt, you know, look how she felt to that, you know, and so that you have all these antennae out about the way other people are responding in the situation too, and it's osmosis almost. You just so that you're kind of neither fish nor fowl in a lot of ways.
Don't you have to keep yourself in terms of being in the theater, then you really have to immerse yourself in it, because you have to also do all your networking at the same time in terms of what's going on and where can I,
oh yeah,
you know, what's cooking here and what's cooking there.
Oh yeah, and you try to go and see as much as you can and stand up with people, yeah.
Your life would be almost a cocoon in terms of the theater. That's where your whole life is. That's where you meet.
It would be easy for that to happen, yeah. It would be, yeah.
Uh-huh. I don't know. guys for doing that. I have a daughter who's going to be performing. Is that the
tell her I wish her well. Yes. Tell her good luck.
She's a little worried.
Tell her I said. tell her break a leg.
She might get literally.
I have most experience with musicians and their stage fright and with their perceived, having other people perceive them and being very worried about that. And
yes.
Are actors like musicians, or do you think they're a different kind of folk?
Yeah, well, there are different kinds of musicians and different kinds of actors, of course, yeah. But that problem of being up in front of other people is very, very real. And I think that I can only speak out of my personal experience, but I know it's true for a lot of other performers as well, that the only thing that saves you from falling apart in front of an audience is the focus on the work that you're doing. And it's not that you don't know that you're in front of other people and that you're performing, but you have committed yourself to the telling of this story. And in the telling of this story, the only way that the people in the audience are going to perceive the story is if I am every second of the time in relationship to my fellow partner on stage. And that we are telling this together, and it's the give and take between us that will tell them the story. And so my only focus has to be here. And so the world of the stage, what you do when you come in, if you're playing a role, is to, first of all, you know the world of the character, and you've gone back everything I'll talk about it in terms of the work, if that's okay, because that's basically the only way I can talk about it. You get the script, you read the play, and you become aware of, how it impacts, whether it's a play that, what the meanings are in it, what the stated meaning is, what the themes are, and kind of become aware of it that way, so that you may just read it two or three times, just for the sake of reading it and becoming really familiar with it. And then you take your character and you just ream out all the data about your character that you can. Every inch of breath of that related to that character. So that the physical kind of descriptions, anything, any references to the way the person dresses, any references, playwrights used to always, like Shaw was maddening about detailing every other breath the character took. Well, most playwrights don't do that now, and it's really refreshing because the actor gets to draw on his inner resources better. But you find out all of the data, all the things the character says, the relationships to all of the other people in the play, what the character says about themselves, what they think, what they feel, if they're always complaining about feeling ill, if you notice when another character, a particular character comes in the scene, this character may respond in a particular way or suddenly become silent, you note that so that you get all of the data about the character you can. If it's an historic character, you read biographies, autobiographies. If it's an historic play, you look at the art, you listen to the music, you research. That's just basic actor research so that you really become familiar with that. And then, I don't like to have my lines memorized before I go into rehearsal because it's in reading with the other person that a lot of things will be discovered. And once you get it on its feet, a lot of things will be discovered. And if you learn your lines early, I find it most useful. Like if a director says, look, I want you to, our rehearsal period's short, come with your lines. Now that's death because it really short circuits the creative process, I think. But if that happens, then you've got the only way to save yourself is to memorize it monotone, memorize words in sequence, because you don't know what that line is going to mean until you're in the moment, until you're in rehearsal discovering it with your fellow actor. And that's when the discovery comes, and it will come here. And all of a sudden the mind will, oh, that's what it means, you know. Because they've told you because of the way they've responded to something you said. Maybe they've even said nothing. So that's what that whole process is. It's very, very exciting. So what we do then, as we go, we'll work a scene, we sit and read it until we feel more comfortable to get it on its feet, and then we'll maybe hold scripts and do it. And finally, when we reach the point where we think we want to put the script down, there may be a debate whether someone may want to try it and one may not be ready to. At that point, you may say, look, let's just improvise it. We know it well enough. Let's improvise it and see what else is here. And that's really exciting, because then you find out that sometimes things are there that aren't in the play. And those things aren't things that you're going to put into the play, but they are things which are going to inform you about other aspects of your character's character or history. Oh, yes, that's right. If it's not an historical character and you don't have data about it, everything that's referred to in the play needs to have a mental image. If there's a reference, if a mother says something to her daughter, come and sit by me like you always did, then you have to, either as mother or daughter, you have to create that memory for yourself. You have to put that fold in your brain about how I always used to sit by my mother. Oh yeah, because she read to me. Oh, I used to watch her needlepoint. Oh yeah, she taught me how to embroider. There was knitting. I remember I sat by her when she got a letter from Daddy. And you're in the house in front of the window, you're on the porch sitting next to your mother, you're in the kitchen sitting next to her doing a job at the table, and you've created all of these memories which the character doesn't have to do, because, you know, the character's on the page. But as an actor, and you carry them in you all the time, because it's your history. So you don't ever have to do this. But when you're playing a character who's on a page, you have to do this for that character, because you've got to make that character as believable as you are with the history you carry in you as a person daily. And so you put those images in your mind. And when you're in performance, you don't have to take time to generate them or to think of them. That's been done. They're there. But you say the line with all of the authority, come and sit next to me like you always did. You know? And it's just there. And she and I both know that those images. One of the most wonderful experiences I had in rehearsal was doing Top Girls with Carol Churchill's play. And I worked with a wonderful woman as my sister. She was playing my sister. And we had such a great time creating this sisterhood. I mean, we didn't know each other to begin with at all. And we had such a marvelous time creating that history together, because she was willing to share it. You can do it yourself as an actor, but if you have a relationship like that with someone in the play, right, and in the story and in the cast, it's, oh, a ball. So then, now we come to the moment of coming on stage, and what do you do with the fact that you're about to make a fool of yourself in front of all these people? Before you come on, you focus on the specifics about your character. I am so-and-so, my father is so-and-so, my mother is this person, my sister and my brother are this person. I've spent the morning getting ready for this in the kitchen, and I've just made tea, and I'm going to go into the parlor and meet these people. And you usually will have some sort of a physical movement as well, which is sort of a physical grounding in that character, so that when you come out, it is said to your body, this is who we are. And then you have the work to do. So you're just focused on communicating this meaning. And always when you're playing the scene, you want something from that other person. You want, I have an objective with this person. And until I achieve that objective, we're connected every second of the time. And once I've achieved it, we aren't unconnected. I've just got a new objective. You know, and it may not any longer, it may be, you know, to in fact complete an action of some kind, but always it's very focused work. And I should think it would be the same with a musician, so that if they commit to the piece, there isn't time to worry about themselves, am I looking right now? It's like with the readers, like I was saying the other day, that with reading aloud for an audience, you think of yourself as a tool, an organ through whom the meaning is going to be shared. And if you've done your work of creating those images, being clear about what the new idea is, and always setting up the new idea, and you know, leaning out toward the people with your spirit in a way, then you're committed and involved in a way that you don't have to worry about gestures and facial expressions and all that. But of course, the gestures and facial expressions and inflections and all have to be available to you. So you don't stay locked in a small frame either. You're always pressing yourself to, you know, to risk learning new things and be challenged by the work. That's why improvisation is so great, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm interested in, you know, your work with you, because I direct a program where we use the arts to help improve self-esteem in young people.
Oh.
And one of the things, to jump back a little bit to what you said earlier about, you know, why would somebody go into theater? And a lot of children, their only exposure to theater is through television and movies. Yeah. And they only see that, you know, you would ask, well, why would you want to go into theater to make money? You know, and obviously there's not the exposure to the theater.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we do is to try to, most of my plays I go to free because I beg everybody for tickets and take some kids.
Uh-huh.
And you know, how do you develop in the young people? I mean, it seems to be, especially very troubled young people are very open to the theater, because it's a way to express and get in touch with some of the feelings in a safe way.
Yes.
They will do a wonderful monologue about a girl who's been sexually abused, and you know it's them, and they've made this whole thing up, and they're able to get in touch with their feelings in a safe way.
Yes. Yeah.
So could you talk a little about what your program does in the middle school?
In dealing with and using that, well, you are more experienced at this than I, because I did the pilot project last fall, and then I hadn't worked in that area for years, really not since we left Valpo in the early 70s, and at that point I had worked with kids from preschool through senior citizen, but it was in different kinds of programs. I used it substituting in schools. I'd go into a classroom and have the kids tell me what they were learning in that class. And then I would invent a theater game for them to explore the material in a new way. And so it was playing, you know, that kind of thing. But that's a whole area I want to learn more about. And it's one of the things that I want to train our teachers to know and understand more about, too, because I think it's just terribly important. My feeling is that with the education system being the way it is, you know, directed in quite a limited, you know, limited ways. Well, there's 7 basic learning styles, and 2 of them are being addressed for the most part in our classrooms today. That there are those kids who are suffering through the day, feeling like they're failures and they don't fit and they'll never belong and they are just klutz and dumb, need to have a place where they're told, look, you know, you're not dumb, you just learn in a different way. And maybe this will offer you a chance to discover something more about that way. And the great thing about theater is that all of the ways are there, so that you can toss up a subject, you know, for instance, in this kind of a group, I would sit down and say, okay, now we're going to have these sessions together. What would you like to learn in this class? And silence. Okay. Well, what sort of things interest you? Or, you know, what do you think it might be fun to work on together? And then a theme or two might start coming out. And so we'd begin to talk about them and let them identify the subject that they're interested in focusing on. And so let's say they would say teen pregnancy. And so then I would get them to talk about all they know about that. Well, I have a friend whose sister, this and that. Well, how? And then I'd try to pull them out. Well, how was it for her? Well, how did the people feel around her? You know, how did you feel about that? And you'd find out things. Well, I always thought she was kind of dirty after that. You know, I always thought that she was sort of, you know, not a very nice person after that. And then, well, how do you think she felt after that? Well, you know, so that they get to really explore it. And then after we elicited all the information, everything, all the body of knowledge in the group about that subject, then I would, try to get that listed in some way so they could see it. And I'd say, well then, now what kind of questions do you think would be interesting to, or what area of this do you think would be interesting to look at? And we'd find some areas, we'd find they don't agree, probably. And then I'd ask them to tell me what sort of way they would think would be fun to, or that they would enjoy coming at this subject to look at it. You know, what would interest you? Would you be interested in working with this with music? Do you think that, you know, is there kind of a dance routine that you think might fit with this? Is there a sketch? Is there a story? Do you want to write a story on this? Do you want to do it as a rap? Would you like to, how should we put this together? And then I would pretty much let them self-select the way they wanted to come together, and I would do my utmost to make it all possible. So, for instance, if one kid said, well, you know, I want to videotape it, I'd choke, and then I'd say, oh, I'll see if I can find you a videotape machine. But I would really honor every way that they said, and everything they said, I would respect that as being, oh, that's your secret. That's the gift that you have. That's the perspective that you have to look at. And then you have something else. Oh, isn't that interesting? You know, let's see. And then I'd say, are there any of you that would like to work together? You know, so-and-so wants to do dance, and so-and-so wants to do rap. Do you think the two of you might possibly work together? You don't? Oh, okay. Well, then, do you have another idea about who you might work with? And I'd spend a good amount of time just kind of orchestrating the event. But what that does is it honors what they've put out. And that kind of, the fact that I accept it, that I think that may be a good enough idea to develop, well, you know, can send you to the moon. And I have no idea what you're going to do and all, but if you know that I believe that you're going to make something of it.
One of my experiences is we have teachers that work with the kids in a variety of different fields in the arts. So we have dance and drama,
great.
Music, the visual arts. And we try to find what it is, like you said, that those young people are interested in. And it always seems to be so hectic and crazy. Because a lot of times I'm looking at it from a little bit of an outside perspective as coordinating the whole thing. And the day before we'll do a performance, I'll say, oh, no,
uh-huh.
The dance doesn't fit with the rap, doesn't fit with the music. And then there's some magical thing that always happens right 10 minutes before the performance. And these kids all say, click, and it all fits together. And I think that's something that they discover. And I think it's what you were talking about. The young people do it better than we do sometimes. They get out of their roles and are able to get into that art. And they find a connection and they get up on stage. Of course, we deal with stage fright the first time and everything. But, I remember we had one girl, she was so angry. She was mad about something and she didn't want to perform. And then she got up and she went away. She was doing some poetry by Langston Hughes, and she got up. And,
oh, wow.
And this was her first time ever getting up in front of a group. And she ran out of the room and a couple of the teachers ran out and they got her and they came back. She goes, I don't want to do this yelling. He said, that's it. Yeah, you're doing good. Put that anger into it. And she came back in, and she had tears streaming out of her face. And she went through the whole poem.
Oh, wow.
And when she got there, the whole room was just silent. And people gave her a standing ovation.
Wow.
And today we're trying to get her into one of the magnet arts programs.
Good.
She'd never been exposed to arts. She was 13 years old.
Oh, good.
And she had a very troubled, you know, family background, and she was able to put her energy into that. And then, we've had people from the outside, some people in the arts come in and say, wow, you know, this is a talented girl. Where did you find her?
Uh-huh.
We said there's hundreds of her.
That's right. Yes, I think that, those kids that go between the cracks just are, it's really, really tragic, whereas it's really the system that's failing them.
I work mostly with black youth and some Hispanic youth, and the school system will tell us that they can't find black children to be in the arts programs, and this is, a lot of it is because they gear it toward those kids that have been, you know, their parents put them in arts classes, class when they're real little.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we kind of challenged them and said, give us a small grant, we'll go find something.
Well, it's the most exciting thing. I think, I really do think that theater is tremendously important, part of culture and all. And I really am very cautious about encouraging anybody to go into the arts. And you know, that old saying, if you can do anything else, do it, has a lot of wisdom to it. But for those of us that can't do anything else, I feel like that is the most wonderful thing that we can do, is to nurture the children, nurture the young people who are struggling in a system which is pretty limited. I mean, our society, what's acceptable is really... We tend to think of it as being wide open, but really, it's really quite narrow. We have a lot of disenfranchised people, not only the mentally ill and the drunk on the streets and the homeless or the unemployed or the people who don't quite look right or the heavyweight or whatever. I mean, we're surrounded by the disenfranchised. And I think that maybe what we are to be is lovers of those people and saying, hey, you know... That's right.
If you remember, it's the worst time of life.
That's right.
If you're a little bit overweight, the other kids will let you know. And if you, you know, if you slip up and you're lying, they'll let you know. But it can be very helpful. And our program, we tie it in with the academics because we have 1 hour of training with the math, science, and English, and then 1 hour of the arts.
Wonderful.
And some children get involved in the arts, but many come because they're very low in their grades. And in fact, we have a teacher who teaches African dance, and a lot of the, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-old boys weren't too excited about dancing. By the end of the 18-week program, they had their tights and their other, you know, and they had made, and they were, you know, and one of the principals stopped by our center after school, and he just couldn't believe all the boys out there dancing. And no one's ever given them the option before.
Yeah, and there are people who really who learn through their bodies. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they can, you know, just like, even like that folk dance.